especially when you do your position yourself in a better position so that you are able to participate.
Going to record the proceedings as well. Because I think we may need a recording. Maybe. I think because we are still waiting for the people to come and make sure that your presentations will be audially recorded, maybe we should invite you to have a cup of tea while we're waiting for that. Thank you.
Thank you. I won't say no to a cup of tea.
Mm-hmm.
Can I get anybody else? Would you like a cup of tea?
I'll come and get one. Thanks.
So the understanding of all of us, including people that we have invited them, of the mandate of the committee is very clear. That the committee, it's like its responsibility is to advise Parliament once received a proposed legislation from members in Parliament, whether that particular individual whom we referred to him or her as a sponsor should then proceed with the amendment, or we don't find substance in the, you know, that particular proposal. So we thought your presentations will then help us to understand whether we should advise Parliament accordingly. Therefore, your presence here is very much important. It's going to help us to achieve, you know, the objective of Parliament. We are going to, I want to believe that the three stakeholders Do you have a program in front of you, all of you? Our presentation stakeholders will then be the first one. They're not here. So I've just been informed that there was a confusion, an alleged confusion that was prevailing amongst the stakeholders, in particular human rights. They are not going to be here. I'm sure they've been given conflictory information. One said the committee will expect them to present today. One said no, the committee has been postponed. I'm not sure how that happened to them, because it should have been happening to all of you, but only them received that. Nonetheless, we would then, we do have a representation coming from the Center for Applied Legal Studies. I'm sure they're here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And they will then be followed by Gender Commission, whom I believe you are becoming familiar with me. You have been in this committee now. I'm sure this is the third, if not. Yeah. So anyhow, you are welcome once again. And we would then invite the Center for Applied Legal Studies to feel calm and be given the opportunity to advise us as to what to understand it on the submission that I'm sure you have been given. What do you understand? What do you advise us to do? Of course, maybe I should also say it up front that your advice, all of you, does not mean it will then become, you know, the decision of the committee. But you will help us to arrive at a welfare balance, you know, well-informed, you know, decision. Thank you, and you are invited to take us through. You will introduce yourself and then take us through. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson. I've got to press this on.
Is that better?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson, to the Honourable Ministers, and to the committee for making it possible for us to come and give presentations here today. My name is Bonita Meyersfeld. I am an Associate Professor of Law at the University of Advaitin School of Law. I am also the Head of Gender at the Center for Applied Legal Studies. The Honourable Dudley MP's choice on termination of pregnancy amendment bill, which I will refer to as the bill, as we are aware, seeks to amend the Choice of Termination of Pregnancy Act 92 of 1996, as amended by the Choice on Termination of Pregnancy Amendment Act 2008. And with the leave of the committee, I'll refer to that act as the primary act. And simply put, it is our submission, we have twofold. Firstly, that the provisions of the proposed bill are inconsistent with the substance and the purpose of the primary act. We also maintain that the provisions of the bill are inconsistent with the broader goal, the broader constitutional goal of gender equality and the empowerment of women in South Africa. And I will, in the course of my presentation, explain that view. But what is the substance and the purpose of the primary act? Well, it is to ensure that South African women have meaningful choice regarding reproduction, and that this choice should include the safe termination of an unwanted pregnancy. Apart from this aspect of the Primary Act, there is a broader constitutional goal which the Primary Act serves. And as I've mentioned, this goal is to ensure that the equality between women and men is achieved similar to the way that we're trying to achieve racial equality, but that it should be achieved by dismantling historic structures that prevent women from controlling their autonomy, their bodies, and their lives.
Mm-hmm.
I have prepared written submissions, and the committee has a copy of it. And to demonstrate why we hold this view, I'm going to discuss particularly three aspects of the bill as we've received it. The first is the requirement that facilities which provide the termination of pregnancies should have access to or the use of an ultrasound equipment. That's the proposed section 3.1H. Secondly, I will speak to the proposed pre-procedure counseling requirements relating to the pictures of the fetus and the content of the proposed counseling. That's section 3.1, Roman numeral 1, Roman numeral 1 to 5. And then finally, I will address a few of the issues in the explanatory memorandum. But may I please raise a caveat before I proceed? We wholeheartedly agree and support the imperative that women's health should be protected and that the services provided to women, including the services of terminating pregnancies, should meet the standards of effective and meaningful health care. And we believe that this is in keeping with the Primary Act, and we would welcome the government's assistance to advance this, but not to impede it. So the first issue under discussion is the requirement that service providers should have access to ultrasound equipment. The ordinary termination of pregnancy procedure does not require the use of an ultrasound. Ultrasound equipment, of course, is necessary in the situation where a pregnancy is carried to term, and it may be necessary in cases where a pregnancy is advanced. But for the majority of the terminations that fall within the ambit of the Primary Act, there can be no benefit or use of an ultrasound. And this is confirmed by practitioners working in maternal health and the provision of termination procedures, and I'd be more than happy to provide the committee with information about the identity of those people if required. But it's not only that the ultrasound does not serve a particular purpose. If facilities are required to have an ultrasound on their premises, this would impose an onerous and unjustifiable and frankly unsustainable financial burden on the organizations providing terminations. Honorable members, many of these organizations operate on donor money, and they are barely able to meet the needs, the health and reproductive needs of the many women in South Africa who seek their services. Imposing this obligation on service providers would force many of them to shut down, simply by virtue of the cost of an ultrasound machine, which is roughly 50,000 to 60,000 rand. And this, in turn, obviously would reduce the number of clinics where women could access safe and legal termination, which in turn would impede women's access to their reproductive rights. And again, this would be at odds with the purpose and substance of the Primary Act. And I think it's worth reiterating that health professionals do not view the use of an ultrasound as necessary to the healthy and safe termination of a fetus. The closure of these clinics would not only impede women's access to termination, but it would also have a detrimental impact on women's health care in rural and impoverished areas of South Africa. Why do I say this? Many termination clinics fund reproductive health care and also health issues relating to termination and the well-being of women carrying to term in areas where government services are very thin on the ground. And the closure of those units which focus on termination because they wouldn't be able to afford an ultrasound equipment would therefore undermine both the reproductive rights of women but also the ability of poor, disenfranchised women to access health care and rights associated with their bodies. I think finally there's also a more pernicious aspect to the potential closure of clinics. The reduction of clinics where women can seek safe termination of pregnancy would lead to a rise in unsafe abortions and consequent maternal mortality. And this is not fear-mongering or mythology. Facilities providing termination procedures spend a great deal of their time and resources preventing and intervening in cases of so-called backstreet abortions or botched abortions. The non-professional, unlawful administration of a termination procedure is extremely dangerous. And the closure of clinics, as we've seen worldwide, when there's a clawback on the provision of termination clinics, such closure is going to lead to an already robust, unlawful practice of terminations. And this has the most dire consequences for individual women, and again, would impede the purpose and the substance of the Primary Act and impede the overall constitutional goal of ensuring that women have the control capacity and right over their bodies. If I may now turn to the pre-procedure counseling requirements laid out in the bill, and those relate to the picture of the fetus and the content of the counseling. The bill proposes the inclusion of electronic pictures, diagrams, and photographs of the fetus in the counseling sessions. And this proposal is justified on the basis that women should receive information to make their choices about termination in an informed and educated manner. It is our proposal that the use of photographs of the fetus is not about information, but clearly about dissuasion. The image of a fetus to a woman considering termination has no bearing on her health or choice and would serve only to dissuade her on grounds unrelated to her health or well-being. Now, this would be, again, at odds with the objective of the Primary Act, which binds the state to provide reproductive health and safe conditions under which the right of choice may be exercised without fear or harm, and I'm quoting there from the preamble to the Primary Act. The bill also requires the provision of counseling, which would warn patients about the alleged dangers of, and I quote, breast cancer, depression, and future difficulties in conceiving and bearing children. The first problem with this imposition is that there is absolutely no accepted evidence to prove a link between safe and informed termination on the one hand and the conditions of breast cancer, depression, or infertility on the other. In fact, Honourable Ministers, the inverse is true. It is far more likely that a woman will experience ill health of the type identified in the bill if she is forced to carry an unwanted pregnancy to term. And we see far more conditions of ill health relating to the woman's body in cases of an unhealthy and unwanted pregnancy than we do in cases of termination. But again, the highest risk in the termination of pregnancy occurs when the procedure is performed by non-authorized providers who are unable to secure the health and safety of the patient. By imposing these obligations, which would limit and impede access to termination providers, again, there's going to be an increase in the number of women turning to unlawful services. And this is a battle that is constantly fought by the authorized practitioners. The bill would weaken their struggle. And it's a struggle to protect women from unsafe abortion. And again, we believe that this would be at odds with the substance of the Primary Act and with the vision of the Constitution to foster a community based on equality and dignity and to break down barriers that prevent that goal. If it pleases the ministers, I would also like to speak to the dangers that these provisions impose as far as delaying access to termination. If the provisions in the bill are adopted, it will become more time-consuming to obtain a termination. This delay would not be in the interests of the patient's health, nor would it further the purpose of the Primary Act to augment women's reproductive choices. The impact of delaying procedures was discussed by the Inter-American Court in the case of Paulina del Carmen Ramirez Jacinto versus Mexico. This was a case decided on the 9th of March, 2007. And in this case, a 14-year-old rape victim was not able to obtain a termination of the unwanted pregnancy, as was her lawful right. A number of delaying tactics were undertaken to ensure that the complainant's choice was delayed until it was no longer safe to perform the termination. and she was required to carry to term. The matter was settled, but the Inter-American Court of Human Rights approved the terms of the settlement, including amendments to state laws to ensure prompt access to termination of pregnancy. And let me be clear, prompt access does not mean uninformed access. Prompt access means not imposing barriers that are unnecessary for the health and well-being of the patient. So this bill would be inconsistent with international developments going forward. We would be going backwards. But it is not necessary to look so far abroad. The matter has received attention in our own region, and I would refer the committee to the Protocol to the African Charter on Human and People's Rights on the Rights of Women in Africa. Apart from being a very long-winded title, this protocol requires states to respect and protect reproductive health, including the right to decide whether to have children, the number of children, and the spacing of children. As regards the importance of counseling, health professionals across the board agree that counseling and education is central to the right of health. And while the provisions of the bill relating to counseling are onerous and contrary to the purpose of the Act, we would support all government initiatives to enhance the capabilities of facilities to provide counseling to women coming in for a termination and to counsel them on safe sex, the prevention of future impregnation, and to ensure that each patient is aware of her legal and moral right to refuse sex if she doesn't want it. I would now like to turn to matters arising in the explanatory memorandum. The explanatory memorandum refers to the modernization of medicine whereby a fetus may be viable after a period of 20 weeks. Members of the committee, this is a most rare phenomenon that it has occurred only in the context of sophisticated private healthcare systems, and it is simply not a reality for the multitude of women in South Africa who rely on limited government health care or the provision of services by non-governmental organizations. And I would urge the committee to preclude that as a consideration in their decisions. The explanatory memorandum also indicates that, and I quote, major financial implications are not expected. Honorable Chairperson, a single ultrasound machine, as I've mentioned, costs in the region of 50,000 to 60,000 rand. This is untenable for most of the organizations, and if it is to be imposed fairly, it would have to be a cost to government. Apart from this direct cost, there is also a hidden cost of providing palliative care to women who endure unlawful terminations, which already is a dire drain on the state's resources. And so our view is that the cost would only increase. By way of conclusion, South Africa has a dishonorable status at the moment of being one of three countries worldwide to see an increase in maternal mortality. And part of this rise is attributed to the illegal termination proceedings. I would be happy to provide the committee with the document from which I source this. It's the Saving Mothers 2005 to 2007 fourth report on confidential inquiries into maternal deaths in South Africa. May I repeat, one in three countries worldwide to see an increase in maternal mortality. It is estimated that unsafe service providers have roughly 60 to 70% of the termination market, and the provisions in the bill is only going to augment that market and increase the risk of mortality and poor health on the part of South African women. We would fully welcome the government support of those practitioners who provide safe termination based on informed consent, taking into account factors that are reasonable and appropriate and in the interests of the broader goal of meaningful equality, of real choice, and the recognition that women can and should be free to choose when, if, and how to give birth. As the bill stands, it is our view that it neither furthers the goals of the Primary Act, nor would such amendments sustain constitutional muster. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. There you are, honorable members. I'm sure we will follow the process of trying to get any clarity-seeking question without, you know, going into deliberations of, you know, the presentation she did. All we need to get, if there's an area that you wanted to be sure that you have had it correct, this is the time. Any clarity-seeking question from members? Honorable Sosio.
Thank you, Chairperson. What I would like to know is if I heard very well that nurses and doctors, they don't approve the use of ultrasound. They don't because of finances, the high cost of the whole material, or they just don't want to, or maybe it's dangerous. Another one with counseling. I understand that people who apply abortion are supposed to be counseled by authorized people. My main worry is about people who are applying abortion by people who are not authorized.
Mm-hmm.
What are the implications there? Thank you.
You can respond.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Honorable Minister.
I should correct that. We are all members here, of course.
I'm terribly sorry. Honorable Member. The question regarding the ultrasound, thank you for raising it for clarification. The nurses and doctors to whom I've spoken would all love to work in an environment in which they had absolutely every piece of instrument available to them that could possibly be used to further a woman's health. There is no, as far as I understand, there is no danger, and I do stand corrected on this, I can't speak medically, only legally, but there is no danger in the use of the ultrasound. What is at point here is that there's no need for an ultrasound for the purposes of providing a safe termination, except where the termination is required in an advanced stage of pregnancy. And there, all the people to whom I've spoken and what's recorded as standard practice, such candidates for termination would be referred to fully fledged hospitals with such requirements and equipment. The bill, however, would seek to have each clinic that provides this facility equipped with an ultrasound machine, which would not serve any purpose. It would, however, as I've mentioned in my presentation, deeply drain the resources of those organizations with very dire impact. They would close down. They would close down. So now I think that in an ideal world, every woman would have access to an ultrasound to determine any number of aspects completely unrelated to pregnancy and for issues completely unrelated to termination. Ultrasounds are very important for identifying, for example, ectopic pregnancies. But I don't believe they're dangerous, but they are certainly not necessary for the narrow purpose of a termination. If I may move to your second question, Honourable Member. The counselling requirement, I could not agree with you more, and that's why we've stressed it, that it's very much a part of the Act as it stands. Granted, the definition of counselling in the Act is broad, but it's quite clear what type of counselling is required to ensure that the person engages in that particular procedure, aware of the nature of the procedure and the consequences of the procedure, scientifically identified. The informal discussions, this is not something that I would say is universal or published or accredited, but my understanding and my experience of clinics that provide termination is their form of counseling is very much about the nature of the procedure. They demonstrate to the individual who comes in for a procedure what technically is going to happen.
They show the instruments. They explain what the procedure is about. They also explain what the consequences are, that the person, that the pregnancy, of course, be terminated. And they try to ensure as much as possible that this is the choice of the individual patient and that this is really what she wants and not something that's imposed upon her. Of course, there are instances where counseling is not properly delivered, but I don't believe that's a problem with the legislation, rather with the implementation of the legislation. And the battle that I do believe we in South Africa continue to fight daily is to really provide for our women in South Africa meaningful, safe termination procedures and meaningful, safe pregnancies if that's their choice too.
Any further? Honorable Pretoria.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Professor, for a very informative submission. Can I just ask a question? We have a submission from a medical practitioner which argues very strongly to the other side, mm-hmm. medically speaking. And you mentioned in your presentation that you can supply medical comment or submissions mm-hmm. which supports your view on the medical grounds. Is it possible that we could, that you can arrange to have one or two of those submissions submitted to us so we can see the full medical picture? That would be my only comment at this stage. I've got an understanding now more of what's happening.
Thank you. Thank you.
May I?
Any comment on that?
Only to say with the greatest of pleasure, the two individuals who have indicated that they're happy to give further evidence, who actually weren't aware of this bill, otherwise I think they would have submitted evidence as well. So if you're still prepared to accept evidence, I think they'd be delighted.
Written is fine.
And that's Diane Cooper and Dr. Vivian Black, but I will find them and get them to submit it.
Of course, we would want any resource document that you said, it might be helpful if
yes.
you can to send it to us so that we can check on that.
Sitting
where you are, looking at the principal, you know, act and the proposed legislation, would you then said it required an amendment of the piece of legislation or regulation, or if not proclamation, may do well to accommodate areas that you are talking about? I just wanted to get your comment on that.
I think my comment, Honourable Member, was that, or Honourable Chairperson, was that as the Act stands, it's a robust, healthy piece of legislation that balances the rights of women with the interests of society. And it's carefully crafted, I believe. The comment I made about intervention by the government is if this is raised as a matter, then we would like to take the opportunity to indicate what's missing at the moment. And probably, as is the case with all matters relating to development and human rights in this country, what's missing is the implementation of legislation and funding for those who are trying to protect the interests of the vulnerable. So I don't believe that there is a need for legislative amendments, nor do I believe that there's even a need for the amendment of regulations. That would be a personal viewpoint. But I do believe that the government, that those providing services in the community would be most grateful for further assistance to do their job in a way that meets the objectives that I would argue strongly we all have in common, healthy individuals.
Thomas?
The question in general, I'm not sure who can answer that. That is in relation to the statement that there will be huge costs involved and that extra machines will have to be bought at 60,000 rand each. How many clinics at the moment operate without these machines? Or maybe I should define clinics. How many institutions or venues, some of them are probably lower than clinics, operate without these machines? In other words, how many new machines will have to be installed to make this thing practical? Is it possible to have that sort of indication?
Honourable Member, I don't have the information as to how many clinics have or do not have ultrasound machines, but perhaps what I could tell you is the information I received from practitioners working in maternal health they and working with women who carry to term to prevent maternal mortality, they are desperate for ultrasound machinery because they need it there to help determine and track the pregnancy as it develops. So if there is going to be the distribution of ultrasound machines, my sense is that the health community would best be served by first placing those machines in the centers where they desperately need it, in other words, in the centers providing health care to women carrying pregnancies to term. So I don't know the exact number of those clinics, nor do I know the exact number of the clinics providing termination, or as you say, the facilities, because they fall under a broader range. But there's initially, before we even get to that point, a much greater need already for that type of sophisticated equipment for women carrying to term.
I think the question will you know fit suitably into the department when they talk to you know this presentation. They might you know clarify that. Is there further clarity seeking question from the professor? And thank you very much for you know finding time to come and present to us. We will then you know consider your presentation when we arrive at the determination to advise Parliament. Once again, thank you very much. And I've been informed that you wanted to be released immediately. You finished, and there will be, of course, the department together with the portfolio committee on health. They were supposed to be part of the stakeholders today, but because of the other commitments outside the country, they're not here. So we are going to have them next week. So they will, you know, still doing what we have done. In case you are hanging around Cape Town next week, you are still welcome to hear how other people view, you know, this presentation. Not necessarily dealing with yours, their own. When you look at it compared to yours, you can add, you know, your knowledge that you have already displayed amongst ourselves. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. And I do apologize to the others who are presenting. For my having to leave early, I have to catch a plane back to Johannesburg.
Thank you. You're welcome.
I'm grateful and wish you all the best.
And you have been, of course, released. You can do whatever you want to do. You can see that mic off. The next presentation will then come from Commission on Gender Equality. Without overemphasizing the matter, we are handing to you. To make your presentation. Over.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm Commissioner Abrams, and this is Advocate Anirudra next to me. Just briefly before I start, Chairperson, I just want to sketch the CG's overall position on reproductive health so that you can see where our position on termination of pregnancy fits. And perhaps the best way to start is to point out that under the United Nations Millennium Development Goals, which get measured every year, one of the indicators is the number of married women who would like access to contraception but who don't have it. And on that particular indicator, sub-Saharan Africa scores the highest in the world. In our submission on climate change last year to Parliament, we pointed out that we also have one of the highest rates of gender-based violence. And we presented the evidence that we have that somewhere between 25 and 30% of all births are actually unwanted births caused by the very high rate of gender-based violence. And because of that, our gender and poverty program spends a lot of time trying to promote access to reproductive health. The reason why I'm introducing this is because I want to explain that the position of the Commission is that abortion is never the best option. It should never be the primary option. It needs to be one of a range of measures addressed at giving women reproductive choice. If anything, it should be the last resort, and clearly in the sense of a last resort, we support it. But we would like to caution the committee not to think of it in isolation, but to think of it in terms of a broader reproductive health policy, and even in terms of matters such as climate change. We've pinpointed population growth as one of the major contributory factors to rising carbon emissions. So it is a big responsibility that the committee sits with. Let me not say the end of the world, but these are not light matters. So that said, clearly the issue of abortion is both highly emotive and complex. It involves the interests of the mother, child, family, and also the community. Occasionally, the state is obliged to protect a range of competing rights. I'm not going to take you through all the legislative developments that brought us to where we are today, but just simply to conclude that the choice to terminate an unplanned, undesirable, or potentially hazardous pregnancy is now a legal right. The Choice of Termination of Pregnancy Act, 92 of 1996, and its subsequent amendment ensures that the right to terminate a pregnancy may be claimed by all women, irrespective of age, location, or socioeconomic status. However, the question that is relevant today is whether the situation actually exists on the ground. And in this context, we thank both the Honourable Member, Ms. C. Dudley, and this committee for engaging with the Choice on Termination of Pregnancy today. Let me just also continue to say that the Commission makes certain assumptions around legislation, and I want to specify that these are assumptions. The first is, as you know, the Constitution requires that every piece of legislation is adequately budgeted. Now, we have a number of cases where this has not happened. Our submission last year on 11 years of the Domestic Violence Act pointed out that it never received an adequate budget. Of course, as a CGE, our favorite bugbear is the Equality Act, in which we were written into the Equality Act. We have certain legislative obligations. We've never since its promulgation ever received a budget to actually carry out those duties. Similarly, the Sexual Violence Act, the Sexual Offences Amendment Act of 2007 has never been budgeted for. So again, we caution the committee. We support certain provisions of this proposal, but we are working on an assumption that should those amendments be made, that they are adequately budgeted and that Parliament adequately follow up that the legislation is implemented as intended. Should that not happen, obviously, then the picture changes. Essentially, we define the right to reproductive health care as a two-stage process. This means that one must have access to the requisite facilities and services, which is the first stage, and secondly, one must be able to exercise this right. In other words, it's not enough that the right exists there on a piece of paper. Even the most remote rural women must physically be able to access it. Against this background, one will find that the Honourable Member's proposal falls in the second stage because the ability to have specialized services such as ultrasonic facilities and options such as adoption canvassed or available for us promotes the realization of a right. It allows one to accept that the state is taking appropriate steps which promotes the realization of the constitutional right to reproductive health care. As I said, opposition is we need to see reproductive health care as a holistic set of services. However, the state, namely the Department of Health, must provide the requisite facilities so that this particular right to access can be satisfied. You've all got written copies of the present. Just to take you quickly through, what evidence there is shows quite clearly that as you increase the legal right to safe abortions, you also decrease the number of deaths due to illegal abortions. As mentioned, we have the world's highest rate of maternal mortality. We're also one of the countries where that rate is still rising. And so clearly anything that we can do to reduce rates of mortality amongst women are good. I'm not going to take you through the detail. You have all the research before you. You have all the references so that you can continue to look it up. The 1994 research gave us a baseline. That's 0.221. The 1999 research shows that as you increase access to safe abortion, the rates of death decrease. And again, the IPAS submission of 2007 shows a similar trend. These measurements, Honourable Chair, they only measure deaths, but I think it's worth pointing out that the number of women who survive illegal abortions but who sit with lifelong medical problems such as cervical infections and so on is also very high. So clearly the Commission's position is the more we're able to extend access to legal and safe termination of pregnancy, the more women's lives we are saving. That with that provision in mind, we feel that there are certain gaps still existing in the legislation relating to termination of pregnancy, which could undermine what we call the provision of access, in other words, the realizable right to safe terminations. And our considerations are as follows. I'm on page 3 now. Number 1, any woman includes minors that may request a termination of pregnancy. That is not yet covered in the Act. The Act doesn't make any distinction between surgical and medical terminations, and that may be a useful distinction. And finally, HIV/AIDS and terminations due to HIV/AIDS infections have not been embraced in the relevant legislation, and we would like to urge this committee to pay some attention to that. And just to go into that briefly, the medical protocol on HIV/AIDS advises that one should not become pregnant. Once one is HIV positive, it's not medically advised to become pregnant. Obviously, notwithstanding, many women do. And the question is, do they then have a realizable right to access safe termination? And it's a complex question with many, many issues. But one of the most overwhelming being that children that are born infected often show developmental difficulties. Particularly when they come to the early learning disabilities and other developmental difficulties. So our consideration is, are mothers being informed of these facts? Are they informed of the danger to their own health in becoming pregnant while HIV positive? We urge the committee to look into that. Then we go on to making the following recommendations. Item number 3 on page 3. Cognizance must be taken of the fact that the, may I say, CTOP chairperson and subsequent amendments have advanced the right of women to safe choice of termination of pregnancy. And the current proposal focuses on section 3.1 of the CTOP, which regulates the facilities which may provide termination of pregnancies. Accordingly, we make the following proposals. Item 3.1. The Principal Act defines the termination of a pregnancy as, quote, the separation and expulsion by medical or surgical means of the contents of the uterus of a pregnant woman. Furthermore, provisions contained in Section 5 of the Principal Act recognize the need for more specialized medical skills in cases that have the potential to be more complicated. Unfortunately, the above-mentioned considerations are not embraced in the current Act, and more especially in Section 3.1. In this regard, we recommend the following. Section 3.1 should include a distinction being made in respect of facilities that are limited to performing medical terminations and those which are authorized to perform both medical and surgical terminations. Furthermore, Section 3.1a is far too ambiguous and should speak to the requisite levels of medical skills required in facilities that offer both forms of termination. These steps will not only enhance the access to high-quality services relating to terminations, but also help in reducing maternal morbidity and mortality rates, especially in cases involving minors and longer gestation periods, in other words, when abortion is performed after the 16-week limit. Our second recommendation, 3.2, according to the Health Systems Trust, the fourth interim confidential maternal inquiry report, which covers the years 1998 to 2003, showed that there was an increase in deaths from 676 to 1,154 attributed to non-pregnancy-related infections resulting from HIV-related diseases. A perusal of the proposals currently before us indicates that this concern has not been addressed adequately, and therefore we recommend that the proposed amendment make special reference to counseling and termination associated with HIV infections. We think that's a very important part of the legislation. The second reason why maternal mortality in this country keeps on rising is obviously because of very high rates of HIV. We can only expect those rates to continue to rise in the next few years. My third recommendation, I'm on page 5. Although the use of ultrasound imaging is recommended, this technology does not come without adverse effects. Prolonged exposure of the fetus to ultrasound waves is discouraged. And may we point out this applies to women who want to keep their children. There are certain medical recommendations around the amount of exposure you should have to ultrasound. In this regard, we recommend that the proposed amendment promoting the use of ultrasonic imaging is supported, provided that the requisite skills are employed and unjustified exposure is discouraged. Now, here, Chairperson, I just want to explain this by taking you back to where we started. If the proposed amendment is properly written, if proper sets of regulations are in place, if there is an adequate budget allocated, and if there is adequate oversight, then it will work. It will work for the reason that, you know, obviously the cost of an ultrasound machine will not be an issue because it will be budgeted for. It will work because the counselor who may recommend the use of ultrasound imaging will be properly skilled, properly qualified, and properly supervised. Clearly, any counselor who were worth his or her salt would not recommend the use of ultrasound imaging if such use would be psychologically damaging to the woman. The woman has certain constitutional rights which any sound counselor will protect. On the other hand, Honourable Chair, if the committee cannot guarantee that those provisions are in place, then clearly the proposed amendment is liable to misuse. That's why I say the Commission for Gender Equality makes an assumption in good faith that should the proposed amendment be passed, that those assumptions will be reality. Our fourth recommendation, the proposal made by the Honourable Member regarding counselling that covers risks such as breast cancer, depression, future complications with pregnancy and alternatives to termination which include adoption are all fully supported by the Commission, and steps should be taken by the Department of Health towards the realisation of this right. And again, Honourable Chair, we recommend this because, as we say, abortion should be a last resort. It should not be a first choice. It is never an easy experience. It is almost always traumatic for women. And therefore, when we put women in a position that that they're not fully aware of the traumatic consequences, then we're violating their right to informed consent. Again, reminding the committee that there needs to be a host of other contraceptive methods in place. Right. In conclusion, the right to increase the accessibility to terminations is still a major problem because the demand for terminations outstrips the number of facilities and medical personnel provided by the state. And the fact that we continue to have high numbers of illegal, unsafe abortions, I think, shows that the demand is much higher than the supply. Accordingly, the ability to choose between a free service at state facilities and an often costly private facility may help to ease the demand on state facilities, but it's still an obstacle in the realization of safe terminations, obviously for the poorest, the most rural, and the most disadvantaged women. Against this background, the Commission on Gender Equality is grateful for this opportunity to comment on the proposed amendments, whereas support is expressed on the initiative of the Honourable Member. Finally, we trust that due consideration will be accorded to our recommendations. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Like the earlier presentation, further clarity-seeking question from the Commission. Honourable Susil.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Commissioner, for your briefing. Commissioner, I think I agree with you that the abortion should be the last resort. But what I would like to ask from you, do you think a person who applied for abortion doesn't apply her mind thoroughly that this has come to the last resort? Because I think it's so good that at least it's done by authorized people. Because before this act, the choice, there were so many done on backyard doctors. But do you think it's people who applied, they need to be told by other people that this must be the last resort? I think they've come to the last result that I've got no alternative, nothing else to do. This is the only thing I have to do. And
I want to know about the people who are HIV positive. If they are pregnant, the person knows that I'm positive, maybe I will die soon. Then now I've fallen pregnant. I don't need this child. And if I die, what is going to happen to this child? Don't you think it's the best if they applied for abortion? That is the best way. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Honourable Member, on your first question, I don't have any research on why women choose abortion, and perhaps it would be a good idea for Parliament to commission. So I can't answer your question based on fact. What the Commission is saying is when we provide enough condoms, when women have, in the most rural clinic, have enough access to contraception, when all those other things are in place, then abortion will become a last resort. At the moment, it's sometimes the only option because those other options are not realizable. They're not there. Well, say you're in a very rural village somewhere and you walk in there and you're 17 and you would like to be put on the pill. You're not going to ask it because that nurse knows you. She knows your mother. So you're going to be too afraid to demand right to contraception. And so you may fall pregnant by accident, then you will go to the nearest big city and have an abortion. So you know, like I say, we don't have evidence, but those are the kind of scenarios that we see when we say, please look at reproductive health as a broad field and at all the options that are available. Don't look at abortion in isolation. That's all we can help you with. With respect to HIV-positive women, all we're saying is that the legislation does not specifically address that, and we feel it should address that. Certainly we feel that HIV-positive women should have access to safe abortions, also because that is the medical protocol. You're not supposed to fall pregnant once you're positive. And our question was around the proposed amendment is not addressing that. There's issues around the protection of medical personnel. There's issues around the health of the mother. There's a whole host of issues which at the moment are not covered by legislation. And we'd urge the committee to consider that. I don't know if my esteemed legal colleague, yes, he has some things to add.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, and Mr. Commissioner. If you look at the Principal Act, it allows for minors to also access the right to a termination. And also the Act further allows such a minor not to be denied this right under any circumstances. Or if you look at within the context of this proposed amendment here, even if that minor hasn't consulted with his or her parent, then he or she still cannot be denied the opportunity to terminate that pregnancy. So if you look at that and if you contextualize it with the report on gym slip pregnancies, we've had thousands of pregnancies. So you find that the likelihood that minors don't have the full hog of, let's assume, counseling and options, you know, canvassed with them, are definitely going to access this right with the ignorance that there are other options available to them. And obviously, a termination is a last resort. So there is a very, very strong likelihood that many are not aware of the other options, or they don't want to know of the other options because they want to conduct this termination in secrecy, especially with minors. And then, of course, you have the pure ignorance in rural areas, you know, where they don't know of the options of, let's assume, adoption. So I feel very, very strongly that the proposal by the Honourable Member is valid and it's necessary, and I support it very strongly based on the likelihood and the probability that the need is great and it will assist strongly. Because if you look at it, there's thousands of people who want to adopt children. And, of course, they will come to the rescue of somebody who wants to terminate. Thank you, Honorable Chair.
Honorable.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Abrams, for the presentation. Just to make one comment, and that is that this committee's function, as far as I see it, is not to necessarily to look at fine detail amendments to the proposal by Member Dudley. That's if this committee passes the principle of what we're looking at here, those amendments will be submitted to the Portfolio Committee in due course. So my question to the Commissioner is my understanding correct that you, in principle, support the proposal wholeheartedly, but you warn in a way that there are practical implications in terms of money and the spread of these machines to all to all corners of the country, basically. Is that my understanding of your submission in broad terms? Is that what it is?
Honourable Member, we are being very difficult. We support the proposed bill, but with the amendments that we have proposed.
Thank you. Further? Okay. I think we're fine. We thank you very much for the presentation. It will also serve as a tool to help us to arrive at the determination. Thank you, and you, if you so wish, you may be, you know, released and do other things. Justice, anything from your side?
Thank you, Chairperson. Just to thank you again for the invitation, as we discussed earlier, and to confirm that Justice, for two reasons. Firstly, we do not have the technical expertise to really get involved in this area. But secondly, more importantly, the important convention that there is a State Department and that this falls squarely and we would not transgress on the terrain unless doing so in conjunction. But thank you very much for the opportunity.
Maybe if you can set your name.
Sorry, Chair, I'm Johan de Lange with the Legislation Development Division.
Thank you very much. That's the position as the department to say nothing to make a formal presentation, but this is a presentation. What they have said is a presentation. Thank you, de Lange, for that very short and to the point presentation of the department.
I hope I wasn't too complicated.
Thank you, Anya. I'm sure this brings us to the end of presentations. Well, thank you very much. I want to thank everybody who made him or herself available to this you know, session where we received these presentations. I'm sure we may not where we are legally proceed with the business of the committee after the hearings. We are not correcting. We don't form a quorum, and we cannot, you know, proceed with the deliberations of what you have said. We will then wait for the quorum to, you know, look into what you have said. Hence, we insisted on recording so that even those who are not here should have, you know, opportunity to look at what you have said and have your presentation in a written form and have an opportunity to listen to what you have said also before we can, you know, arrive at determination. I'm sure Honorable Sosivo, you'd take this, you know, concern to the authority of Parliament that we can't have a committee that it keeps on sitting and not, you know, correcting, listening to the presentations of stakeholders prior to them and without, you know, dealing with them and doing justice so that we discharge our work. And I think you are aware that we're sitting with a lot of, you know, new proposals that are submitted to the committee. That therefore we need either Parliament to reduce the size of the committee to a reasonable size that we will be able to do our work because we can't advocate for the whole year being unable to form a quorum in order to deliberate on issues. But nonetheless, thank you for making yourself available. And thank you, honorable members, for coming. We will meet again next week on Friday, hoping on Friday we will then have a quorum and then to deal with all the backlog, which might mean the meeting on Friday, honorable members, might then mean we don't have to book flights for 2 or 3. We should book for 7, 8 in the evening so that we deal with all the backlog behind us. I know you will be going for recess. You have already told your families that you are coming. But looking at where we are, we might have to extend our, you know, sitting into the committee on Friday so that we reduce the, you know, what is sitting with us. We have got, this one is the fourth that we have received presentations, but we are unable to deliberate on the simple reasons of quorum. So we can continue operating that way. Anyhow, thank you very much.
Maybe we don't call the meeting on Friday next week. We call the meeting maybe on Tuesday. I know very well that they will come. They will all come. Then we have the meeting the whole day on Tuesday so that we deal with all. But if we say on Friday, we might find the same situation because they will be telling us that they are rushing home, they have the funeral, they have this and that over the weekend. But if we call it on Tuesday, knowing very well that we are closed, but they have to come to deal with this work that is outstanding, maybe they will all come.
Of course, you know, they are authority to give that permission. We may not just decide sitting here. And then do you know that they wanted, you know, yeah, they wanted, they used the law effectively. So that, thanks, Honorable Pretorius.
I accept, Chair, that we have a challenge with times because many other committees sit at the same time. Tuesday, for example, SCOPA would be sitting again, and at least three of this committee serve on SCOPA. The suggestion would be for the powers to be to consider sitting after hours, sitting after the House is adjourned. Members will be in Cape Town in the middle of the week, and from our side, we will support such a proposal. And I agree with you, we must get together very soon because these things are all getting stale now, and we must talk to these matters when they are fresh still.
I think it's a good proposal from Honorable Pretoria, but problem it will be maybe transport. Because sometimes if we want to organize transport for members, to deliver members after the buses have left, they refuse. Sometimes they refuse.
We
have to try, but
we will look at all possible avenues in our disposal, including, you know, sitting after hours. If that has to be considered, also transport to be accommodated should be considered. We will look at sitting in either of the, you know, weekdays that we may have. We will while you will go and meet with the Chief Whip and explain this. I will go to the House Chairperson also to outline this and give, you know, the history of the committee. You know, it is unfortunate that we warned them in advance when they pushed us to the Fridays to say. Last year we were allocated slots on Friday. We could not operate. And then we then, you know, negotiated to be given Tuesdays. And we made a significant progress. We were, you know, every day correcting, you know, giving, you know, the necessary progress of the work of the committee. And then later they then said, no, everybody has been, instructed to go back to the original date of slot that you have been allocated, including yourself, meaning us. So we made a submission, say, look at the history of this particular committee. Maybe that history that we were talking about, it wasn't necessarily only about Friday sitting, failing to correct the history in totality of this committee. This committee has never been, you know, enjoyed the support and the usage of the, parliament and public at large. We brought in the turnaround strategy kind of, you know, system, which is seeing a lot of submissions now. Now we are receiving submissions, that attitude, that, you know, perception that, no, this is just that committee. It started to be proven wrong because now we need to do the work. So we have got no, I'm sure even when they were allocating us members, they were saying, no, let's look at those that are not committed, who will ever have other commitments outside Parliament. Hence, you know, because there are other committees that are sitting on Fridays, and they're doing well. We are supposed to sit on Friday. We are not doing well. So it tells you that the history of the committee, because the work that we have already, you know, done so far, it's equal to the work that this committee have done in the past 15 years to where we are. The work that we have attended to from last year to today, it is more than the work that the committee has been doing historically from 1994 to 2009. I mean, it's amazing. Obviously, somewhere this historical, you know, background that have proven the committee not to be a committee of parliament, it is playing a significant role. Therefore, for us to change the attitude and the way the perceive of, you know, members of parliament and parliament itself of this committee, it lies with us. Therefore, it is a mammoth task to turn it around. So, but it's up to, you know, honorable members and you know, the management of the committee to do everything possible to change the way in which the committee has been perceived in the past 15 years. We are starting to say this government is not delivering. In the past 15 years, it failed to do 1, 2, 3. They are saying, no, we are dealing with the legacy of 300 years plus. Now we are saying, whoever said, no, but you're often not, you know, delivering, you're sitting with a lot of submissions, who then said, no, we are dealing with a legacy of 15 years. We are changing something that has been, you know, sitting there for 15 years. And, you know, I'm sure you are aware, honorable members, that even members of parliament does not know of this committee. Members of parliament, what about a person outside? Why are we not receiving, you know, special petition? It's because sufficient work was not done. I'm sure, yeah, anyhow, we must not mourn and complain. We must find a way of how do we get out of the mud. We are stuck in the mud, but we must find a way. How do we apply 4x4 wheels, you know, to get out of the mud? Then maybe you might help us.
I know that it's not my turn to be speaking this week, but I just, in line with what you're saying, I was just wondering if it's not because of perception that nothing is going to go through. It comes here just to be ignored. So if we can change the perception by actually stirring up some things going through, people will be way more alert and aware to the fact that you need to be here to interrogate what's going on. So because I do think there is a perception that this is just something, no matter who says what, it's not going to happen. So it could help to stir things up. Thank you.
I would want to support the Honourable Dudley because I'm trying very hard to get my own personal bill through the committee, but it's a difficult process.
Members to the committee so that it gets out.
Yeah.
When there are no members, there's nothing we can do. We can't.
Secondly, to confirm what you're saying and to strengthen your arm in a sense in your negotiations for more time and authority for this committee, from our side there are at least 2 but possibly 3 bills, proposals coming to this committee within the next month or two. And there could be more because there's a specific action on our side to use this committee as a mechanism to get legislation on the table. So honestly, we can't carry on like it's happening now. The rules do allow the committee to deliberate without a quorum. We can talk, but the moment you take a decision, you need a quorum. And the difference between talking and taking a decision is a very fine line sometimes. So, and it's also unfair for three people to talk and then delay a decision until you have seven or eight people here and then just take a decision while they're here. So I would support the suggestion that we structure this in a proper fashion and that operate as a professional committee. At the moment, it's very flimsy and it doesn't reflect well on Parliament.
So thank you very much. The meeting is...